Raylene and I, when we first got married, didn't have a lot, which is pretty normal for young couples, right? But we were 22, and we were just getting out of college, and we were kind of just scraping things together. And also, we just didn't understand how some stuff works. For instance, knives. We registered for a knife set, and we went to like Target and other stores, and we're like, knives are really expensive. That's kind of ridiculous, right? Like, I don't know where they have the gall to charge hundreds of dollars for a knife. I mean, it like chops a tomato. Why should it cost $80 when the tomato costs 80 cents? This just seems a little bit unreasonable. So we registered for this knife set. I think it was like a Faberware or something like that, and a family member bought it for us, and we were like, sweet, we have a knife set. We can do the things in the kitchen that we need to do. Because when you don't have money, you don't eat out a lot. Eat out much, and so you're doing a lot of food prep at home, and that meant that we were chopping a lot of vegetables up to cook with. So after about 9 months of marriage, there was a problem. That knife set, I think, was meant to just be on a counter, looked at by people who eat out a lot and don't want to spend money on knives. And so after 9 months of use, it was just pitiful. You'd go to slice a tomato for a sandwich and you'd end up with spaghetti sauce, right? I mean, it's just like right through the tomato and you're like, what is going on here? And so we were just aching for new knives. We're like, this is not cutting the mustard, pun intended. And so we're watching TV one day early in the morning, which I don't know why we were, we didn't often, and this guy came on and he was selling his knives. His name was Ron, and he runs this he runs this thing called Ronco, and you wouldn't believe it, he's a genius. He's got knives that can do like everything. He's got like a knife accessory set, like ladies have jewelry sometimes, right? He's got like a knife to match his shoes and his wallet, and it can cut pennies in half. He's got kitchen shears that will make snowflakes until the cows come home. It was a beautiful thing, and it hit us just at the right time. Plus, he has things like rotisserie ovens that can roast a chicken in half the time that it would normally take you to roast a chicken in your normal oven. I mean, this guy had good news for us. And so we're like, I don't know, this seems really cheesy, but we need knives. And then this amazing price flashed on the screen. These knives weren't going to be ours for $99.95, not $49.95, not even $19.95. We were going to get these knives for $9.95 plus $4 shipping and handling. So the whole thing came out to like $13 and change, and we were like, well, let's give it a shot. I mean, like, what's the worst? They can't be worse than the knives that we have now. And so we ordered our Ronco knives, and they came, and you wouldn't believe it. They sliced tomatoes like you'd never sliced a tomato before. Now, I don't know why, but on knife commercials, the guys, they're like, see how thinly I can slice this tomato? And I'm like, that's because you're cheap, buddy, right? when you go to Subway, you're like, tomato. More tomato. Okay, one more layer of tomato, and that's how I would slice a tomato at home, right? Like, when you put tomato on a sandwich, you want a chunk of tomato. Anyways, so it got the job done, and we were really glad to have these knives. But the truth is even those knives wore out. Not quite as quickly as the other set, which was a little bit surprising, but within a few years, we were kind of like, well, these knives are kind of a bummer. So I learned to sharpen knives, which is a good thing. And then eventually, our friend actually gave us a really nice set of knives because he was no longer going to be selling Cutco. So that worked out really well in our favor. Yeah, some of you have been there too, I guess. Anyways, it's really funny because in life, we often think that these things are going to come along and save us from our problems, right? And sometimes they do. We had a knife problem. I was making tomato sauce instead of sandwiches. I really wanted just a slice of tomato on my sandwich, but instead I was getting like goop that I was spooning onto it in a little embarrassed way. Thankfully, I was just serving myself. But we hope that these things will come along and save us and solve the problems. But the truth is they don't. So, Soren Kierkegaard, who is this theologian and philosopher, he's worth reading if you've never heard of him, he says, it is the normal state of the human heart to try to build its identity around something besides God. Soren is saying that we need something inside to define us besides ourselves. And we're hunting for that thing, we're looking for that thing, we're longing for that thing, and we're automatically wired to build our lives around an identity. For some of us, it's our career. For some of us, it's our family name. For some of us, it's money in the bank. For some of us, it's our relationships. or our scholastic success, or our brief short sports career in high school or college, but we're looking for something to define us, to build our lives around. A guy named Timothy Keller, who is a theologian and a pastor in New York, continues, and he says, "The human heart searches for something that will give it a sense of worth, a sense of specialness, a sense of purpose, and builds itself on that. And of course, we are often reminded, if you try to put anything in the middle of that place that was originally made for God, it is going to be too small. It's going to rattle around in there." So Keller continues to build on the thought, and he just says, if we do that, it's going to be inadequate. If we do that, it's not going to fit right. If we do that, we're going to sense the void around that small thing that we've tried to build our identity around. And so we're all in this situation where we need to build our identities around God, but our flesh and the world are pulling us, and the devil are pulling us towards building our identity around things that are not God. Sometimes it's really silly things, like a car that we own. Sometimes it's really important things, like what we can do, our talents and our gifts. But either way, they don't take the place of that main thing. And so in the text today, we're going to look at who David, who we've been studying all summer, built his life around. Who gave David identity? And that person is the Lord. And so if you open up your Bibles, if you've got them, with me to Psalm 23, we're going to be checking out the Song of the Shepherd. Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, and my cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David was a king, right? But before David was a king, he was also a shepherd. And we don't know when in David's life he wrote this song for God. We don't know if he started writing it when he was a shepherd, how he observed that God was near him and walked with him in the way that he was near and walked with his sheep early on, and then finished the song later. We don't know if bits and pieces of it came to him while he was hiding in caves, running from Saul early on in his kingship, before he was actually placed on the throne, yet anointed by the prophet Samuel. We don't know if he was writing these verses while he was leaving Jerusalem because his son was kicking him out. We don't know if he was writing these verses in the midst of God's kindness towards him after making major mistakes, like sending a man to his death for the sake of keeping his sin hidden in private. We're not sure when this happened, but we do know that this psalm is true in all of David's life. And we do know that this psalm is true in all of our lives. And so David starts out with what I think is probably his most famous psalm. He says, "The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing." Now, when we look at the text here, we have to observe this is a statement of absolute confidence. There's no wavering. It's a strong affirmative. The Lord is my shepherd. Not the Lord might be my shepherd. Sometimes I can rely on God. Occasionally, when I whisper a prayer, he shows up and answers. Occasionally, when I show up to church and I'm faithful to him, he is there hearing me out. Occasionally, when I need him, he walks with me. But sometimes, I don't really know he's there. Sometimes, I can't really see him. Instead, he says, "The Lord is my shepherd." There's just an awareness of this. Isn't that a comforting thing? That if we are God's, we know that he is our shepherd. We don't have to doubt it. We might not see him. We might not understand what he's doing, but we can have confidence in that fact. How many of you have ever been driving in your car when all of a sudden the brakes aren't working anymore? This happened to me once. Yes, it's kind of scary, right? This happened to me once, actually the first year of our marriage as well. I was driving our 1987 Ford Crown Victoria, which I nicknamed Noah's Ark because it was a giant boat. And I think that it could probably fit every animal on the face of the earth in it for a long time. And so I'm driving down the road, and all of a sudden, I've got no brakes. And the problem is, this car weighs like 2 tons. I mean, it's a behemoth. It still had a steel frame. And so I'm pumping, and I'm pumping, and I'm pumping. I've got nothing. And finally, I come to a stop, and I'm like, what in the world is going on? So I drive home, and I'm like using the emergency brake, which is super awkward, because I'm like 2 foot driving, because the emergency brake is a pedal on the left-hand side, and I'm like pushing that down, and then grabbing the release, and hitting the gas again. It's really weird, and really frustrating. And so finally, I get home, and I find out my brake line broke on like the right driver's side, the rear brake. And I was like, man, this is terrible. So I had to like figure out how to install a brake line, which I'd never done before. But I couldn't trust that my brakes were there. And I learned something. There are things in the world that are absolutely unreliable, right? Things that aren't gonna be there all the time. And sometimes we project that onto God, especially when people in our lives haven't been faithful to us in the role that we've needed them to be. Like our parents, or our siblings, or our friends, or teachers, or Sunday school leaders, or other trusted adults. And then, as we walk in our relationship with God, we don't think that He's always going to be there, because other people have let us down, because other people have walked away when we've needed them, because we've made a phone call hoping we could trust a friend for help, and they couldn't. And we can forget that God is our shepherd, that He is there, He is with us. Another thing about this shepherd is that this is kind of an odd juxtaposition, right? God is the creator of all the universe. He spoke it into being. He made everything that's there. Colossians says He causes the universe to continue to exist. He sustains it. He rules it from His throne right now. And yet He's my shepherd. It's personal. He's near to us. While He is awesome and omnipotent and all-knowing and everywhere, at the same time, He is personally available to you and to me all the time. See, a shepherd doesn't just check in with his sheep once or twice a day. He's not putting us in a pen and dropping hay off and bringing water and then driving away. A shepherd in that day walked with his sheep. He guided them. He was with them. He knew them. He understood them. He gave His life to those sheep. There wasn't going home at the end of the day. Staying with those sheep was everything. And He cared for them immensely. What an amazing picture is it for us to be able to think about the fact that this God who made everything loves us and knows us in such an intimate and personal way that He can be called our shepherd. Not just our caretaker, not just the God who made us, but in fact, our shepherd. And what's even more cool than this is that we know that this shepherd is Jesus specifically. Ezekiel 34:23 says, I will place over them, as in my people, one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them, and he will be their shepherd. Isaiah 40:11 says, he tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those that have young. Jesus in John 10 says, I am the good shepherd. The shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. See, Jesus comes to us, and He reminds us, I am your shepherd. He's calling out to us, gathering us to Him. He even tells His disciples who were in Israel, I need to go to another flock and gather sheep that I have there as well. Jesus is the good shepherd. When you trust Jesus as your Savior, you're not trusting Jesus just for a future eternity in heaven. You're trusting Jesus for this relationship now. You can trust Jesus to be close to you, to walk with you, to speak to you, to comfort you, and guide you. This is good and awesome news. I can't help but think of as well the beginning of John chapter 1. See, I think that this chapter in the Bible paints this picture of Jesus as being the shepherd in a really unique and interesting way. And it kind of points out this contrast between Jesus being the preeminent God of all creation, existing before everything, and speaking it into existence. It says the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It says that by Him all things were created. Nothing came into existence without Him. And it talks about how Jesus was with God, but then this Word came and dwelt amongst us. Jesus came to be our shepherd in a literal sense, in a person-to-person sense, in a walk-up-and-touch-you sense, in a have-a-conversation-with-you sense, in a very real, thick, and meaty sense, flesh and blood on the earth with us. And not just a shepherd who drove around in a nice truck, but a shepherd who suffered everything that humans suffered, went through sickness, lost friends, dealt with persecution, died on the cross for your sins, because He so desperately desires to be your shepherd and to call you to Him. This is a shepherd like no other. This is the shepherd of all shepherds, and He longs to know you and be with you. That's a crazy and bold image of God, right? Who would dare to call God their shepherd? But you know what? David does, because his heart gets God. He's a man after God's heart. And so David continues, and he says, I lack nothing. I lack nothing. Which of us can boast that here today? I feel different lacks in my life. They're just there. Sometimes I lack what it takes to be the best husband that my wife deserves. Sometimes I lack enough money in the bank account and I'm waiting on God. God, can you bring the things that we need? Sometimes I just lack courage to have the difficult conversations that I need to have with people in my life with whom things aren't going perfectly. Sometimes I lack the patience to deal with my son kindly. Sometimes I lack the love to seek out my family members in the way that that they deserve for me to seek them out. And so I forget about them, and it'll be a couple weeks before I call my brothers or my grandma or my parents. David, walking closely with the shepherd, says, I lack nothing. Because David understands the heart of his shepherd towards him. Because David walks with his shepherd closely, and he recognizes that God brings him everything that he needs. And so he moves on, and he says, He makes me lie down in green pastures, and He leads me beside quiet water. He refreshes my soul. It's not that the shepherd is just meeting David's needs in an eternal sense, right? What does a sheep care about heaven? Have you ever had a conversation with a farm animal about next week? Probably pretty one-sided. Moo. Meh. I didn't think it was a good choice either. Thanks for letting me know. They're farm animals. Now, I don't want to degrade us to farm animals, and I don't think that's the point of the text. There's lots of talk about how we're like sheep and we're dumb and all this, and honestly, some of those things can be true of us at times. But more importantly, God knows that we have real needs. And He's not like, hey, listen, I know you're hungry, but heaven's going to be awesome, and I'm making a big marriage feast so that when you get there, we're going to feast for like years. It's going to be epic. So, you know, just wait. I know you're tired of saltines and ramen, but it's going to get better. He's like, no, I'm going to provide for you in real terms. Now, sometimes we have our hearts set on things that we don't need. And sometimes God doesn't meet our physical needs because He's drawing us to Him. See, the things that we have difficulty with in life aren't just meant to like make life rotten, right? But they're actually meant to draw us close to God. He's calling us to Him. He's reminding us that life is like grass. It's here for a moment and then it withers away. He's helping us know that there's an eternal reality, a spiritual reality that's greater than our current reality. And yet David, who I'm sure had difficulty in his life, we just talked about a lot of those, says, He makes me lie down in green pastures. He provides for me the things that I need in a real sense. But I think there's also a sense of this where God provides not just our physical needs, but our spiritual needs and our emotional needs, that God wants to fulfill who we are in his person, himself. Now, at the beginning, I quoted Kierkegaard and Keller, and they talked about how we're trying to build our identity around something, that we're seeking it out, and that we often choose small things that don't really fill the space that God is meant to fill. And so God makes us lie down in these green pastures, because in our hearts, in our brokenness, in our fleshiness, we won't lay down and be satisfied with what God has for us. We'll seek satisfaction from the wrong things, and they'll seem to fill us for a moment, but then they'll leave us void and empty. They'll fill our hunger for a season, but then, at the end of that season, they'll actually leave us more hungry and worse off than we've needed, than we were before. Before I became a Christian, I was totally lost. I was seeking after affirmation in relationships. I didn't have an identity of my own. And so I thought that girlfriends could help me feel better about myself. I thought that getting good grades could help me feel better about myself. I thought that driving a cool car with a bumpin' sound system would make me a good guy, an awesome guy. In the end, all those things left me wanting. And God started to expose to me the depth of my sin and the greatness of my need for him. And when I finally surrendered, he made me lie down in the green pastures of his love and forgiveness. And it was good for my soul. It refreshed me in ways that none of those other things could refresh me. It connected to my heart in ways that no song I'd ever heard could connect to my heart. Because all of these things were just filling that void temporarily. Only the good shepherd can make us lie down in the green pastures that will fulfill us and refresh us. David says that he leads us besides quiet waters. How many of you played the game Oregon Trail growing up? I know there's going to be a generation gap there, but like when I was in grade school, we had these computers called Apple IIe's, and it was like a microwave and a TV in one, and it also had a slot that you could put a disc in. And we had computer time a couple times a week, and we would go to the library, and we would have this time, and we played this game called the Oregon Trail, which was really interesting because I was from Illinois, and we were like, cool, Oregon Trail. And you would like buy a cart and oxen and food, and you would leave from St. Louis, Missouri, and you were trying to end up at the end of the Oregon Trail. And all sorts of calamity would befall you on the trail. For instance, you would go to cross a river, and you would be like, well, I can pay the ferry, or I can just cork my wagon and float it across, and since I'm poor, I'm going to cork my wagon. And then it'd be like, rocks have smashed your wagon to pieces. Timmy dies. And you're like, duh. And then you got to like buy a new wagon, and an ox dies. But then there's this thing that happens every once in a while, and that's that someone in your party gets dysentery, right? And you're like, oh, great. Like, how am I going to deal with this, right? And this like stick man pops up, and he's got like the death face, and you're like, this is not good news. And the reason they got dysentery is because you didn't have fresh water to drink. And so they'd be like looking for water, and they'd be like, hey, there's water. And then they drink it, and it turns out that something pooped in it, and now you're going to die. And I'm really sorry. And so you'd get dysentery and die. And this is a reality that's faced the world for thousands of years. We don't realize this because like we pipe fresh water into our homes that you can actually trust, which is really cool. But in most of the world, it's not that way. And having clean water isn't something that everyone in the world deals with. And it certainly isn't something that they got to deal with back in the time that this psalm was written. They would have known the importance of finding fresh, quiet, cool waters. On the Israeli plain, which is actually like a desert, okay, and it's rocky and hilly, the ground is baked hard, and so when it rains, it floods. And so these weren't rushing waters that when you approach to get water, you might fall in and drown and die. And these weren't stagnant waters that have been sitting there so long that they've got diseases and you're going to get like dysentery or cholera. This is a spring of quietly moving water that provides an oasis to your soul. Isn't that a cool picture? that your shepherd knows that in the busyness of life, in the difficulties that you face, that he's going to lead you to places that are good and perfect, that will bring you rest, that will bring you peace, and more importantly, that will refresh you. That your shepherd is actually planning to take you there on that journey. Isn't that cool? Raylene and I have these friends named John and Janelle. John and Janelle are in ministry, and they taught us a lot about ministry. And every year on their birthdays, the other plans a whole day just for them. They don't have kids, and so their life is given to God in ministry, but they celebrate each other well in their lives. And so every year on the other's birthday, the other thinks about what they can do for that person that would refresh them, that would bless them, that would love them. And so they plan this whole day that's going to be a celebration of their spouse, that's going to just bless and encourage them. It's a really cool thing. And one year I asked, like, hey, John, what did you guys do for your birthday? And he was like, well, we slept in till 9, and then we went to the waffle window, which is a cool place in Portland where you can get delicious waffles, and John likes good food. And so they went there, and then they went home, and he got to play with his Legos for a couple hours, which sounds silly, but John builds Legos, and he actually like consults with the Lego company and helps them build better Lego sets. And then they went to lunch, and then they went on a walk, and they had a quiet and romantic dinner. But Janelle knows John enough to know what is going to refresh his soul. And Janelle used that opportunity to take John to a place of quiet waters in the midst of a busy season in his life. John's birthday is around Christmas, and I don't know if you know this, but Christmas is a busy time for pastors. Like, it's just crazy busy. And so in the midst of that, Janelle prepared this day for John that was perfect for John's heart. In the same way, your shepherd is preparing days for you that are good, that refresh you, that restore you. God wants your heart to be whole, not anxious. And so he's moving you through life in a way that is designed to build wholeness into you rather than anxiety. Now, there's a couple of biblical pictures of anxiety. But one of the pictures is actually this picture of brokenness. Take a mirror, hit it with a hammer, shatters into hundreds, thousands of pieces. Who can put it back together, right? Nobody. That's a picture of anxiety biblically. That you lack wholeness, that your heart and your mind have been fractured into hundreds of pieces to deal with all these little issues, and they all pile up, and so none of them get all of you. And you get none of you because you've been broken up in these little ways. This refreshing that God is bringing is a total renewal. It's not just a light refreshing. It's not going to the powder room to polish up. It's not taking a breather, grabbing a cup of cold water in the midst of mowing a lawn. It's a complete recreation of your soul so that the brokenness that you had without your shepherd is gone, and you have wholeness and newness in him. I get chapped lips sometimes. Do you get chapped lips sometimes? Chapped lips are a bummer. And the worst is when you're chapped lips, you go to greet someone and you smile, and you like feel that one tight thing of skin like go boing, and then you know you got like this prickly sticking out, and then you're like, this is not good, because you know they're going to start cropping up all over, right? And your lips are cracked and broken. And you bring chapstick in, and you put that salve on, and it soothes, and it comforts. And after a few days, your lips are like new again, right? Because your skin regrows, and they're completely refreshed, and they're touched up. God is like that for our souls. Our shepherd is bringing the salve that will heal your heart. He's bringing the goodness that your heart and soul long for. Moving on. In Revelation 7:17, it says this, "For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." God wants to bring wholeness now, but there will be a time in the future where if you trust God for your salvation, if you seek to obey God with your life through the power of His Spirit now, that the wholeness that I'm talking about will be like none that you can imagine. The goodness that God has for you will be so present that you could hardly stand to live without it now. See, God is bringing you to progressive wholeness so that when you get to your home in heaven, so that when He leads you to the springs of living water, it will be something familiar to you, but it will be way better than you can imagine or even ask for. Psalm 23b, David says, "He guides me along the right paths for His name's sake." Literally, He guides me on paths of righteousness for His name's sake. See, the shepherd leads you to good places, but he also leads you through difficult decisions. I've faced several difficult decisions in my life. One of them was choosing to come here. It's not an easy choice to uproot your life and move to a new place. I've done it twice in my life. And the first time, Raylene and I were really young. We'd been married a year, and we moved to Wilsonville, Oregon, from Elgin, Illinois. And we did so joyfully and with excitement. We felt like God was calling us there. We didn't know what was ahead for us, but we knew that God was moving us. And so we listened, and we came, and we followed Him. And we saw God provide for us in some amazing ways. But also, we learned that it's really hard to leave your friends and family behind. It's really hard to start new relationships. It's difficult to find a church, but then not just to attend that church, but to infiltrate that church and actually become like a part of the body in a meaningful way. It cost us to move across the country, and not just in a literal sense, but in a figurative sense. But God guided us on His righteous paths for His name's sake. So in making this decision to come here, I knew the thing that I needed to do was ask God for guidance. And so Raylene and I prayed about coming here a lot. We looked at all the facts and we went, man, this is going to be tough. This isn't what we thought that we wanted in this next season. See, I want to be a full-time pastor, and I love you guys and I love working here, but not being a pastor full-time means that I work hard just for the privilege of being your pastor, and you're totally worth it. But that is extra work. And my heart gets divided between my part-time job and what the calling of my life is. And that's okay because God has designed that for me in this season, and I know that it's a good thing. But that meant in looking at coming here, I knew it was going to cost us, and I wasn't going to do it if it wasn't the right path that God was guiding me on. So I needed to seek my shepherd. I needed to hear His answer and His call, because the path that He's guiding on me is right and good. But if I choose to go my own way, that's not a good path. So I talked about the desert, the hilly land, the countryside that David would have led his flock in. In eastern Washington, as you're driving along the hills in cattle country, there's this really cool thing, and that's that the hill will go down, and then there's like a little path, and then it'll go down again, and there's a little path. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you'll see cows walking on those hills, and they're all grazing in these little paths. Because over the years, hundreds and thousands of cattle have walked along these hillsides grazing, and they've worn paths into the hillside. Those are good paths. They're paths that contain the things that the cattle need. In the same way, shepherds led sheep along the paths in Israel. And so these steep, rocky hills, rather than being dangerous and unsafe, are good paths for their feet to stand in. They're paths that lead them along the rocks and the crevices where little shoots of grass grow up to feed them. They're paths where they're not going to slip and fall and hurt themselves. They're paths that aren't going to lead them into thickets where they're going to get caught in the thorns and the bramble. They're paths that are the right paths for them to take, made for them and their nature as sheep. God is seeking to guide you along the right path for His name's sake. The psalm takes a turn here, Psalm 23:4. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff comfort me. In the midst of this psalm of God's providence, of His love and grace towards us, David's real. It's not sunshine and lollipops every day of life, right? There's difficulty in the midst of life. God leads us into the valley of deepest darkness. This is confusing to me sometimes. I don't like the valley of deepest darkness. Maybe you do, but I don't think I've met anybody who really does. I don't like it when my marriage is rough because I've done something dumb. I don't like it when a friend or a loved one is going through a difficult season and I don't have answers for them. I don't like it when I lose someone. I don't like difficulty, and that's okay. You don't have to like it, but God leads you through dark seasons. In the midst of that dark season, though, he doesn't abandon you. He's not like, here you go, have at it, you got it, don't worry. He walks with you. And so David says, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will not fear. I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. See, David has learned through his life, through the difficulties that he's faced, that God is always with him, that God's rod can correct him at times, but that correction is good, that God's rod will protect him from enemies so that he himself doesn't even have to protect himself. How many times was David so close to Saul's grasp, and yet he always evaded him? David even lived with the Philistines, who were the Israel's enemies for a season, and God protected him. Before David was king, David killed a giant by God's hand, not his own. David faced life's difficulties knowing and trusting that God had his back, because his life wasn't just his own. He was the shepherd's sheep, and he could trust God in that. He also knew God's comfort. He knew God's comfort in the affliction of the rebellion of his son. He knew God's comfort in his sin as he took Bathsheba to be his own wife from another man. He knew that God drew him near for his sake because he loved him. And then the psalm takes another turn, and it moves from this pastoral imagery, right, where David has been talking about being a sheep and God being his shepherd, to all of a sudden there's this image of a table, and there's an image of a throne room or a king's house or at least a tent. It'd be kind of weird if God was still talking about us like we were sheep at this point in time. Like God is gathering a bunch of sheep in and setting them at the table and like having tea with them. And you're like, what is God? Like some weird four-year-old boy? Like, no, God is bringing us in as friends and he's welcoming us. And so David says, you prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies, and you anoint my head with oil and my cup overflows. See, in Israel, you taunted your enemies. You see this in pictures of battle, right, where Goliath is taunting the Israelites, and they should actually be taunting the Philistines back, but they didn't because they were really afraid. This is the way you used to do battle. You taunted your enemies. The taunt here isn't, we're better and stronger. The taunt here is, our God is so awesome that in the face of you being at our borders threatening to invade our lands, that God prepares a lush and lavish banquet for us, that he gives us the things that we need, so much so that we can come in and we can have a wonderful dinner together, and I'm not going to fear that you're going to come after me, enemy. I don't have to worry that you're at my doorstep because I'm in God's house, not my own house. And so David boasts in the face of his enemies. God prepares a table for me. I memorized this psalm as a little kid, and I thought this was really weird. And I had this picture in my mind about how God was moving me or anybody through this deep, dark valley, and then you're like in the valley, and all of a sudden, like, pop, there's a dinner table, and God has prepared a meal for you. And how weird would that be to be in the presence of enemies who could come and get you and do harm to you, and yet you can trust that God is protecting you in the midst of that? That's a really cool image. That can give a lot of confidence as you face difficulties in life, as you face challenges from your flesh, challenges spiritually and temptation, difficulty in relationships, that you can trust and rest in God's goodness for you rather than having to live in the fear and the frustration of whatever difficulty you're facing. And David gets really specific here. You anoint my head with oil. After a dry day, putting on lotion feels really good. It's really dry in Israel. And so at the end of the day, they would come in and someone would wash their feet. They would get cleaned up, and then they would put on oil just to make things feel better. Jesus tells the Pharisees, or tells his disciples, don't fast like the Pharisees who make a big show of it, but instead do everything you would do every day. Put on oil, get cleaned up. In their culture, it's really dry. It's really refreshing to be anointed. He's saying, God, you're refreshing me in the midst of this difficult season. And not only that, but you're refreshing me so much that I can keep coming back to you until I've had my full. Literally, that statement of my cup overflowing means you've filled my cup to satisfaction. You've given me everything I've needed, so I don't have to worry about the situation. I'm just complete and whole and full in you. And this psalm keeps kind of bringing us back to that image of this shepherd providing for us everything that we need and being full in him and not lacking anything, not needing things from another source. And so David concludes the psalm, surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. We don't have a word in our language that can describe the fullness of God's love. The goodness and love that David is talking about here is from a word that I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce because I don't speak Hebrew, but growing up, the church I grew up in, we called it hesed love. Hesed love is a faithful love that never stops, never gives up, and never ends. Kind of as an antithetical example, the thing that I think of is the IRS. The IRS faithfully seeks to get from you what you owe them, right? Like, as a government entity, that's what they were set up to do, for good or for bad. That's their job. And so every year you have to file your taxes, and then you're hoping that you don't get audited, or if you do get audited, that everything pans out right and then you're not going to owe them more money. Or if you're like an independent business owner or a general contractor, you know that you got to make extra tax payments throughout the year because you owe them a little more than the average person. And if you don't pay them enough over the course of the year, they might fine you and ask for interest on the thing that you owe them. And so then you're going to owe them more because that IRS, they're going to seek after you to get what they deserve. In the opposite way, God seeks after you to give you what you don't deserve because he loves you so much that he wants you to have it. And so he sent his son to die for you. And so he sends his spirit to dwell in you. And so he sends his word to guide you and to comfort you and teach you. God's faithful kindness and love towards you is so much that he as a shepherd will seek after you. And the word follow in this passage just reiterates that theme of hesed. See, it's not follow you like a dog. It's not following you like a best friend. It's following you like an enemy pursuing you, which again is kind of a weird contrast. Have you ever had that feeling like somebody's following you, you look over your shoulder and you're like, what's going on? Like you just kind of like creeped out, like weirded out. I have this sometimes in the dark here because I'm kind of afraid of bears, probably because they can eat me. And just the other day even, I heard like a bear grunting around in the field by our yard. And so when I go out at night, I'm like, I wonder if there's going to be a bear and what will happen. And I understand that bears are like afraid of us, but at the same time, it's got fangs and teeth, and I don't. I have like molars and incisors and no claws. And it's got like 400 pounds on me. So I'm afraid of bears, and that's, you know, that's me. That's cool. Don't buy me bear spray. I'll just like clap my hands and make myself big. I know what to do. We don't have to fear, though, because God is with us. God is with us so much that his mercy and goodness and love are following us. They're with us everywhere we go. God is actually waiting to bless you with good things. It's kind of a weird picture. We don't often think of God like that. And so David concludes, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. If God's goodness is with me like this now, forever I will be with him because I am his. He is my shepherd. I am his sheep. He's called me to his table. He's got good things in store for me in an incredible way. And he will bless me and love me and guide me for all eternity. And so the psalm ends. This is kind of a weird text because there's no firm application points. There's no like change this behavior and say this to your wife and go home and do this thing differently. But what's interesting is the application then becomes harder. Because the question of the text then is, who is your shepherd? What are the things, or what is the thing in your life that you're seeking to build your identity around? And is it rattling around in there yet? Is God exposing to you the smallness of that thing? Or have you found that he is your shepherd? See, I've found that I trust God to shepherd me in some areas of my life, but not in every area. And so occasionally, and less often, I find I'm not trusting God to shepherd me in this. Sometimes when Raylene and I argue, I have a hard time trusting God to shepherd me in the midst of that. I have a hard time remembering that God's goodness and mercy are following me around and that he's looking to bless me. I have a hard time remembering that I'm not waiting for Raylene to lead me by quiet waters, but I'm waiting for God to lead me by quiet waters. Sometimes when I'm doing this pastoring thing, I start to rely on my own strength too much and don't rely on God's. And so in the midst of that, God's like, rattle, rattle, rattle. It's not about you. Don't build your identity on the gifts I've given you. Build it on me. In other seasons of life, I've had to learn that my identity isn't built around my humor. My identity isn't built around having good times with my friends. My identity is built on following and trusting the shepherd. Is yours?